This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 1st, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Aid agencies not allowed into Iraq grow increasingly concerned as conditions inside Iraq are critical. The Turkish army and families of American soldiers voice opposition to the war. And the Supreme Court begins hearing a case that could turn back the clock on civil rights and racial justice. But first, these news headlines.
With the headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pauline Bartolone. Fighting continues in the southern city of Basra, in which running water and electricity were cut off last Friday, posing dangerous health risks to those forced to use polluted water sources. United Nations officials are warning of the danger to children from untreated water. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
In the southern city of Basra, 100,000 children are at risk of severe fever and death, according to a spokesperson for the United Nations Children's Fund based in Amman, Jordan. He said dirty water causes diarrhea, which in turn leads to deadly malnutrition, especially in infants. The city's power grid was hit on March 21st, soon after the invasion began, shutting down the main water treatment plant. Because of fighting, safe water has been restored to only half the inhabitants. The source of the damage is disputed. U.S. and British military commanders say civilian infrastructure isn't a target, but water treatment plants were bombed during the 1991 Gulf War. Sarah Zaidi is with the Center for Economic and Social Rights.
The water infrastructure has not only been damaged by 12 years of comprehensive sanctions, but in the 1991 Gulf War, the coalition forces at the time bombed water infrastructure.
UNICEF officials fear the Basra crisis could spread to Baghdad and other cities. They say the need for clean water is becoming especially urgent in southern Iraq, where the temperature is nearing 99 degrees Fahrenheit. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
In other news, a pickup truck crashed into the British embassy in Iran last night. Pejman Hagigi has a story.
The Islamic Republic news agency IRNA reported that a pickup truck crashed into the wall of the British embassy compound in Tehran last night. The driver was a 35-year-old man who worked for the energy ministry. He died instantly due to the intense fire. According to IRNA, he was carrying two 220-liter barrels of gasoline and several 20-liter barrels of kerosene. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hamid Reza Asafi called the crash an accident and said that the driver lost control of the pickup due to the rainy surface of the street. This comes only 3 days after tens of thousands of Iranians marched in Tehran and protested the American and British-led war on Iraq and burned effigies of George Bush and Tony Blair. Later, police used warning shots to disperse about 1,000 demonstrators who had gathered in front of the British embassy, throwing stones at the building, shouting that the British ambassador should be expelled. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pejman Hariri.
Domestically, the American public is starting to feel the effects of a struggling economy, as the U.S. Congress is considering a $75 billion emergency spending bill to fund the invasion of Iraq. Bush continues to preach confidence, but big business is not listening. This lack of business confidence is leading to job cuts in some of America's biggest companies. Ama Bouadi reports.
As the war draws on, the U.S. public is being told that the economy is robust enough to withstand the current period of uncertainty. But with large companies announcing job cuts, there seems to be mounting evidence to show that the economy is still suffering. The Labor Department will confirm on Friday that an additional 29,000 people will have lost their jobs in the month of March. This news comes as Kmart announced more job cuts, American Airlines narrowly averted bankruptcy, and today AOL announced that it has cut an additional 420 jobs at its customer service call centers across the country in an effort to, quote, slash annual expenses by $100 million. For FSRN, I am Ama Bouadi.
A witness in a case of a University of Idaho student accused of having terrorist ties has just been released after 8 days of detention. Abdullah Al-Kid was held as a material witness after his arrest at Dulles Airport with a one-way ticket to Saudi Arabia. Lee Robartis has more from Idaho.
Authorities say U.S. Muslim convert Abdullah Al-Kid will testify against Saudi University of Idaho doctoral student Sami Al-Husayn, who was his friend when the two attended school together. Al-Husayn pled innocent to multiple visa fraud charges after 100 FBI agents descended on Moscow, Idaho, February 26th to arrest him. Prosecutors say websites al-Husayn created while at school were used to gather money for terrorism. Case documents portray a web of transactions, including $20,000 paid to al-Kid or his wife. Federal raids and arrests at Islamic charities in Michigan and New York State occurred simultaneous to al-Husayn's arrest. Since then, arrests of two other former University of Idaho students have been linked by authorities to the case. An INS detention hearing is expected today. Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Pauline Bartolone with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
CNN is reporting that the Iraqi Information Ministry today said that the shootings earlier today of two buses, which left nine Iraqi civilians dead, in fact also took the lives of American Human Shields who were aboard the buses. He said, quote, "Those people on the two buses are Human Shields coming to participate in defending civilian installations like water sanitation stations, electricity generation stations, and so on." U.S. Central Command said it's investigating the claim. Efforts by FSRN to contact Human Shields in Baghdad to confirm this report were unsuccessful as we went to air. Meanwhile, the Australian government today said its Navy's role in the war with Iraq had almost ended and two frigates involved in the operations in the Persian Gulf will return to Australia by the end of this month. As the war intensifies, the situation for people inside Iraq is critical. Cassandra Nelson of Mercy Corps, currently based in Kuwait, says many aid agencies are growing increasingly worried that they will not be able to bring the necessary relief to the now very needy in Iraq.
Well, actually, at this point, no humanitarian aid organizations or UN or staff has really been allowed to enter into Iraq. And so we don't have that on-the-ground assessment that we'd like to have at this point to fully understand what the needs of the communities are. Now, certainly we have been getting reports, and there have been some people who have gone in. Certainly we get information from military and from the news and a lot of other sources. And what we do know is that water is one of the number one concerns in the south. In Basra, still half the population there doesn't have access to clean drinking water, and there are reports of them drinking out of the river, which has raw sewage in it. Kasa today had a water pipeline that was started that is getting some drinking water into the city. There's been some issues with distribution, making it available to the entire population, but they do have water now there for the population. In terms of the other critical needs that we're hearing about in the south is the need for medicine. In terms of food, we've been getting reports that they have enough food in most cases to last them through April, or at least until near the end of April. So although that is a major concern going forward, we do have a little bit of time to address that issue.
So, Cassandra, we've heard reports at this end of, say, US-UK bombing campaigns taking out water facilities. Is that where the water problems stem from?
The water problem really stems from the lack of electricity. In Iraq, the water system, the purification system, is driven by electricity. And in the military campaign, generators and major power plants have been knocked out. So that has been what's caused the lack of drinking water in these communities.
How is it then, if you're not being allowed into Iraq, or humanitarian aid groups like yourself are not being allowed into Iraq, one, who is stopping you from coming into Iraq, and two, how serious is this crisis? If you're not allowed in, what's going to happen to the people in Iraq?
Well, the way it's working is that the U.S. military and the British military are manning the border. We're in Kuwait, and also the Kuwaiti government obviously has control over the border. They have, until today, declared the area not permissive, which means essentially that we cannot cross that border. Certainly, I think everyone here views it as a very critical situation, and people are ready to go in as soon as the security situation is stabilized somewhat.
Cassandra Nelson of Mercy Corps is currently based in Kuwait. Secretary of State Colin Powell is on his way to Turkey today as part of a global travel swing that will also take him to NATO headquarters in Belgium as he tries to drum up more international support for what many around the world see as a failing war against Iraq. Powell will also try to convince the Turkish army not to invade northern Iraq, a move the Turkish parliament approved 2 weeks ago. Turkey has the third largest army in the world after the United States and Russia, and the fourth most powerful after the US, Russia and Israel. Every male Turk must serve in the army, but as Aaron Glantz reports from Ankara, as 90% of Turks oppose the war, so too do many of the rank and file of the Turkish army.
Nihat sips tea in a cafe early in the morning. The 24-year-old holds a degree in business administration from one of Ankara's better universities. In a few hours, he will report to the local Turkish army office. Like almost every other Turk, he is against the war. But if the Turkish army invades Iraq, he may be part of the force that fights.
I don't think there's a winner in war. It's just a lose-lose situation. I think war is just because of the economic reasons, and I just don't want to fight for other people's money, that's what I think.
Like many young Turks, Nihat lacks a steady job. Despite his degree in business administration, his only income comes from standing in front of the Syrian embassy early in the morning, helping people fill out paperwork for their visas. He makes about $4 a day doing this work, and he says he has been unable to find a better job, partly because no one will hire him until after his mandatory military service.
What they basically said to me was, I don't want to employ you just because you haven't completed your military service, because you're going to go sometime in 2 years, maybe.
Nihat's friend Urash sits across the table. Urash is active in the environmental group Greenpeace. 2 weeks ago, he strapped himself to a U.S. military caravan as it crossed from the Mediterranean port of Iskenderun onto Turkish soil. Urash is able to continue to defer his military service because he takes one or two university classes a semester. But in a year, he will graduate and face the same decision as his friend Nihat. Urash says he will join the dozen or so conscientious objectors in Turkey.
Nobody can order me to learn to use a gun which has no point of use except for killing someone. A gun is used only for killing, and I don't want to learn how to use a gun. I have never touched a gun, and I won't ever. I refuse to wear that uniform with everybody else because I'm not the same with everybody else.
Turkey cracks down hard on conscientious objectors, which is one reason why there are so few. In a high-profile case last winter, conscientious objector Mehmet Bal was jailed and shackled in a basement cell for refusing to serve in the army. Even objectors spared such harsh treatment face subtler forms of punishment. Conscientious objectors are barred from leaving Turkey, and they are forbidden from holding government jobs.
We have a saying like every Turk is born a soldier, and it's really a big shame not to serve for military. That, you know, you cannot get married because no father would let you marry his pretty daughter because you're a shameless man, you know.
It's a traitor, you know that. I don't have to go to the military to serve my country. I can serve my country in a better way.
24-year-old Nihat is one of the tens of thousands of Turks who reported to the army today. If the Turkish army invades Iraq, he may be sent to fight. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
And it's not just the Turkish army that's in opposition to the war. A growing number of American families whose loved ones are being sent to the front lines are voicing their opposition to the war. Charlie Richardson from Military Families Speak Out says he and many other families are speaking out in the hopes of stopping the deaths of their children and innocent Iraqi civilians.
My son was actually deployed in August and has been over there or has been under deployment since then. His unit was supposed to be coming home relatively soon. They were supposed to leave for the transatlantic crossing sometime in the next week or so. And they've just recently been turned around, and instead they are heading into the fray.
So, Charles Richardson, how do you feel when people say that we must support our troops and to be anti-war is not supporting the troops?
I think we need to support the troops, but the best way to support the troops, the most important way to support the troops, is to put an end to this war. This war was wrong before it started, and it's still wrong. And the idea that since it started, we should now somehow shift and act as if it's a good thing, to me, doesn't make any sense. If I saw my son getting into a car with a drunk driver, before they drove off, I would try and stop them. But after they have driven off, I would still try to stop them. And I think my son and all the rest of the troops are, frankly, in a car being driven by a president who's drunk with power.
How many families like yourself do you think there are across this country who would have similar feelings about their children fighting this war?
We are in direct contact with over 400 families at this point, and we think that there are many, many more every time we go to a demonstration, every time we appear on a radio or a television show, the number of people that are contacting us goes way up.
Charlie Richardson, how does your son feel about, one, fighting in the war, but two, that his parents are so openly against this war?
We don't speak for our son. Only he can do that. I'm only speaking for myself in this situation. He knows what we're doing.
Finally, what message do you have for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and the people who are essentially driving this war at the Pentagon?
Well, I have two messages. One is for those people, and that is that this war shouldn't have started, and we need to end it. We need to rebuild our relations across the world. We need not to be killing innocent civilians. We need our troops to not be in harm's way. But the other message is to military families across the country who are opposed to this war. Get in touch with us. We have a website, www.mfso.org. Together we can both support each other and be a strong and important voice in trying to end not only this war, but the policies that led to it.
Charlie Richardson from Military Families Speak Out. Today, the University of Michigan will defend its affirmative action policy in front of the Supreme Court. Legal analysts warn that not only could a ruling ban race-sensitive admissions policies, but could also lead to the resegregation of all sectors in society. A racially and economically diverse group of young people have led the national effort to preserve affirmative action and have since been joined by civil rights groups, labor unions, and professional organizations. Ingrid Drake caught up with the thousands of civil rights activists mobilized in Washington, D.C. to hear about the significance of this case.
Last night, an estimated 2,500 students, primarily from traditionally black colleges and universities, marched from Howard University to the Supreme Court to demonstrate their commitment to preserving affirmative action policies. Many of the students, who planned to spend the night on the cold, windy sidewalk outside of the court, said it was the first time they had felt passionate about an issue to take to the streets.
My name is Jamila Lemieux. I'm a Howard University student. Right now, you have thousands of brothers and sisters, other minorities, people from all over the country, unified to see affirmative action brought into the full and truthful and fair light that it should have been brought to when it first came into existence. This is very serious. We need our voices heard, and people need to realize the severity of the situation, and things don't look that good for us right now.
This morning, the group of cold but energized students were joined by thousands of people from across the country who arrived at the Supreme Court in buses chartered by churches, labor unions, and student organizations. Many people expressed their belief affirmative action is one of the most contentious issues because it challenges white privilege and forces Americans to critically examine our country's legacy of racism.
Hi, my name is Miranda Booker, and I'm a graduate student at Howard University. Discrimination is still alive and well, and racism is just as American as apple pie. So there's definitely still a need for affirmative action, and affirmative action is a forerunner for reparations.
My name is Bambi Harmon, and I live in Maryland, and I'm actually passing out reparations is the answer, because I think that we have to look at how this country has benefited from slavery, and I think that this ties into the need for affirmative action for children who are coming of age, for generations that are coming after us, and we need to acknowledge the benefits that this country has gotten from slavery. And I think that one way that we can look at reparations is through higher education.
Affirmative action was created to remedy past and current racial discrimination. However, lawyers for the University of Michigan are not defending their policy to the Supreme Court as a way to desegregate higher education, and instead are arguing there is a compelling interest for the use of race-sensitive admissions to help create a diverse student body. Will Schumann, a second-year law student at Howard University, is one of several law students who do not find this to be the strongest approach to preserving affirmative action.
When the issue is couched into whether diversity is a compelling interest such that additional points being given on the basis of race would be constitutional, that sort of disguises what the real problem is, which is not whether or not it's a compelling interest, but whether or not it's something necessary to remedy a lot of the past discrimination the University of Michigan has taken a part of itself.
While Michigan's policy has been held up by many educators as one of the most fair and effective affirmative action policies in higher education, it is only one of many schools that have been targeted by a network of right-wing think tanks and foundations, such as the Center for Individual Rights, the Federalist Society, and the Bradley Foundation. These groups are credited with trying to overturn the gains of the civil rights movement by advocating for private school vouchers, welfare privatization, and the elimination of ethnic and women's studies departments. The Supreme Court ruling on this case is expected this summer. This is Ingrid Drake reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
In a speech Sunday to the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, or AIPAC, in Washington, Secretary of State Colin Powell said Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip are, quote, inconsistent with President Bush's two-state vision. Before Powell's speech in Washington, a suicide bomber blew up a cafe in the coastal settlement of Netanya, injuring 49 Israelis and killing the bomber. This is Palestinians across the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip mark the 27th anniversary of Land Day with demonstrations. On March 30, 1976, the State of Israel confiscated a large swath of land from Palestinians living inside Israel's so-called Green Line. During ensuing demonstrations, six Palestinians died, and now the date is marked each year. Kristen S. reports from Deir Blah, Gaza, on how land confiscation and the bulldozing of Palestinian farmland by the Israeli military and increased settlement activities have Palestinians worried that the war in Iraq will distract international attention from human rights violations in the occupied territories.
As Palestinians noted the 27th anniversary of Land Day in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip over the weekend, thousands of Palestinians, many of them women and farmers, took to bulldozed fields to replant small trees and to the streets to rally in support of the Iraqi people and to demand their own rights. Ahmed Sarani, director of the Palestinian Agricultural Development Association in the Gaza Strip, says that Land Day encompasses many aspects of Palestinian suffering under occupation, from land confiscation to 1948's UN Resolution 194, granting the individual right for all Palestinian refugees to the right of return to lands and homes inside the current borders of Israel, land they were forced from when Israeli forces destroyed Palestinian villages in order to create an Israeli state.
The Land Day means also that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their homeland, and they are not anymore living on this land, and they look forward to come back to this land, or at least to be given a chance to decide to come back or not.
A volunteer for the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, who prefers to go unnamed, working in the frequently invaded northern Gaza Strip area of Bet Lahia, says that the strategy of the Israeli military in confiscating land ultimately undermines Palestinian environmental and economic sustainability.
Big problem here in the Palestine because of the destroyment of this forest or this trees. Maybe some time to tell the world that Palestinian people have bad environment.
The Israeli government continues to restrict Palestinian use of its own water while diverting a heavy percentage to its settlements. Mahmoud Abu Rama from Gaza City's Al-Mazan Center for Human Rights cites the Fourth Geneva Convention to illustrate the illegality of Israeli settlement building and land confiscation,
which clearly prohibits the transfer of the population of the occupying power into the occupied territories. By doing so, Israel is breaching the law.
Ahmed Sarani of the Palestinian Agricultural Development Association explains that Israeli settlements have control over the highest quality of natural resources in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip.
So they are capable of using these resources, natural Palestinian natural resources, for the agricultural production. And they are not actually doing this only, but they also transfer a big quantity of Palestinian water from Gaza Strip to the north of Negev Desert for irrigation purposes for the newly established agricultural settlements.
As they observe Land Day, over the weekend, Israeli forces killed four Palestinians in separate incidents, imprisoned an estimated 100, and injured dozens. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kristen S., reporting from Dirabella, Gaza Strip, occupied Palestine.
Late last week, the World Council of Churches denounced increasing violence against Dalits in India. Meanwhile, as the Dalit 100-day campaign to end discrimination draws to a close, the Dalits, who are the lowest rung in the Indian caste hierarchy, are visiting villages with banners, cups and saucers as they attempt to end systemic caste discrimination, which Dalits say is on par with racial discrimination. Dalits constitute one-fourth of India's 1 billion population, and two-thirds of these 250 million Dalits are illiterate, and most are poorly paid and exploited landless labourers. Binu Alex reports from the 100-day campaign in Gujarat.
For centuries, India's lowest rung group in the 3,000-year-old caste hierarchy posed no questions to serving separately from others. But last month, these untouchables, also called as Dalits, have started a campaign in the western Indian state of Gujarat to end this custom.
Right from morning when a Dalit wakes up to the time when he comes back home after a day's work, he knows his enemy very well. Such is the treatment by the upper caste Hindus.
Valjibhai Patel is a Dalit and heads the Council for Social Justice, an NGO fighting to end the discrimination. Dalits follow the ideology propagated by Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar, who was also instrumental in framing the Indian constitution in the early 50s. A Dalit himself, he embraced Buddhism, saying that though he had no choice in his birth as a Dalit, he will not die as an oppressed. But many believe his followers deviated from his ideals to suit their benefits and instead joined hands with their own oppressors.
Baba Sahib Ambedkar has preached that his fight should be followed, if not continued, to gain self-respect and social freedom. We have failed to follow his teachings and ideals, and that is the biggest failure among the Dalits. The entire caste system is an ideology, followed by the powerful to oppress the Dalits. Unless you break the system, there is no way out.
The constitution had outlawed discrimination on the basis of caste and introduced quotas for government jobs, political representation, and education for the Dalits. This is pretty similar to the US practice of minority set-asides. This was meant for the social upliftment of the Dalits to the mainstream, but instead, it created a hierarchy within Dalits. Some called themselves high caste and started practicing the same discrimination with the lower among the low caste. Discrimination is also common, even for highly qualified Dalits like Yogesh Maitrak. A postgraduate with a PhD, his employer suspended him for silly reasons.
We are supposed to say him, sir, so why don't we break him at the initial stage? This is the main reason. I can give you the examples of n number of it. And just because of the caste.
Recently, 5 Dalit youths were lynched by right-wing upper caste Hindus while they were doing their job, skinning a dead cow. Cow is revered by Hindus, and the lynching was justified by the Hindu leaders, saying for them, the animal was more important than the young lives. But Dalits were accused of taking part in the sectarian violence between Hindus and Muslims that killed over 1,000 last spring. But Patel believes the charges are politically drawn.
You will find 4 things together: a Dalit, a Muslim, a mosque, and a dustbin. They are interwoven with each other.
Many escape this discrimination by converting to Christianity or Buddhism. But the right-wing BJP party has made this an issue for their attack against the Christians. After coming back to power, the Gujarat government will first bring a bill that will ban conversions and thereby leaving options for protest through door-to-door campaigns. From Gujarat in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.